What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Krofcik, and we are on the verge. And for those who have listened to us, you may interpret that we have been on the verge of what, you say, John?
What are we on the verge of?
A breakdown? A breakup? Well, let me give you some choices, John.
Okay.
We are on the verge of stardom in the podcast universe, or folding up our tent and putting our camel to bed. Rounding up all of our listeners and buying a plot of land in Oregon and starting a cult. What are we on the verge of, John? Or none of the above?
We'll have the podcast cult.
We all go out and I get the Kool-Aid and we start drinking. And you have to listen round the clock as John and I do various podcasts.
We'll ramble on.
Right, we ramble on. And people will be running for the hills, I can imagine. Well, when in truth, we are on the verge, John, of learning more about the field of predictive analytics.
Yes.
What do you think that is?
Well, you know, I think this is interesting. I think it's analytics are all around us now.
Yeah, and we do a lot of podcasts about it, don't we?
We do.
But we're fascinated with it. Why are we relying on these numbers? Why is it that we think we can predict just about every aspect of human behavior simply because we've got a lot more quantitative tools available to us? But this doctor that we had, Dr. Rebecca Costa, and the first thing that amazed you about her was the fact that I described her as a sociobiologist.
Yes, that was kind of odd. What is a sociobiologist?
Well, don't we ask her that question
yeah,
in the podcast?
Do. Yes.
I'd rather she explain it than me trying to explain it. So if you've never heard a sociobiologist before, well, today's your day.
But she's a good teacher. I told her so. I think she could teach a course in whatever she does.
Yeah, that was really, it was so interesting because we didn't know how difficult this interview was going to be, just understanding what she was going to talk about, predictive analytics. But she was fascinating.
She
now,
was.
She's done a TED Talk. I saw her there. She's really good. But I still didn't know. You know, sometimes you get into these conversations and you're wondering, am I going to be able to extract the information that I want to and make sense without babbling on like...
No, she was great. This is a podcast worth listening to because she is a good teacher.
And to keep it in your head, I think a lot of people should think about, say, Alvin Toffler, Future Shock, or people like Thomas Friedman, who kind of get above us 30,000 feet, and they're big picture thinkers. So this woman is not only a sociobiologist, but she is a futurist. And she tells us that really we've got so many tools available to us today such that if we really still use some good human judgment, there's no reason necessarily to fail. Because you don't go into a business when you don't look around and say, wow, I've got a storefront here and there's not another storefront and there are no cars coming by, but I still want to start the business. Well, you can do that and you can fail, but you don't really have to. And there's really no excuse for it any longer.
Because we have analytics.
We've got analytics or analytics or I don't know how we want to describe this. So you can get the data and all the inputs, but you can avoid mistakes or even calamities. She's telling us that by way of what it is that we can learn, we can even avoid, hopefully in the future, if we assemble enough information, mass shootings and other things that really bedevil our society today.
Well, that's wonderful if all this is true and if we have enough computer power to process it. I mean, that's the whole thing with all this data is is we need to have these big machines to process it. It's just
but the big machines are now, well, they could fit on your fingertip.
But we still haven't got weather down. That's one that affects us.
I think you brought that up as part of the conversation.
But we're working on it.
Okay, she'll talk about that. But let me give you some foreknowledge, John, because I've got it. Having experienced it firsthand, this podcast is well worth your time.
It is.
And we're on the verge of bringing it to you right now.
Rebecca Costa is with us. The book is called On the Verge. And you're a sociobiologist. What is that?
Well, that is a good question. It's not as though everybody's meeting sociobiologists every day.
No.
In truth, that's a person that studies evolution and the effect that human evolution is having on the way that societies evolve.
And so
things
are there
like public policy and habits that we develop, trends,
interesting,
basic human behavior, and why evolution plays a role in that.
Are there many people studying this form of science or no?
No, it's a pretty rare and focused form of science. My particular area of expertise is something called fast adaptation, which probably brings it more down to earth. Effectively, you know, we're moving at such a fast pace of change, not only in the environment, but just think about how quickly technology moves and facts move and, you know, and we're all tied to these digital devices to try to keep up. But when you think about it, there's two clocks. There's the rate at which human progress begins to accelerate, and then there's the rate at which we develop new biological features, if you will. For example, I could use a bigger brain right now. And I could certainly use a faster brain and a lot more memory. And, you know, not to mention I need more appendages than my car is suited for. I mean, I want to work my nav system and my music system and every other thing while I'm trying to drive a 10-ton vehicle, right?
Well, pretty soon you won't have to be driving it, so you can do anything else that you'd like to, because all the sensors will be providing those eyes in the back of your head and on the sides and so forth, and that's part of the technological advancement that you were talking about.
That's right, but with every technological advancement, there are unintended consequences, and I have to remind everyone of that because, you know, as soon as I start talking about robotics or predictive analytics, which is what my new book is about, you know, people get a little bit spooked.
Yeah, absolutely. And John and I were talking before you came on, we were talking, and he's a little bit skeptical about our ability to predict and to end risk. And you, of course, tell us that there is a path forward that's moving in an accelerated way. So what are we on the verge of?
Well, we're on the verge of knowing the future, which is a massive sea change from where we've been in the past. As you know, historically, kings and leaders have brought in seers and psychics to anticipate whether they were going to win wars and, you know, how they might die and so on and so forth. But they didn't have the computer predictive models that we have now. And we're garnering so much data, and our computers are getting so smart at connecting dots that we're seeing patterns that we have never known existed before. And one of my favorite examples is when I tell people that I can predict with, you know, somewhere between an 85 and 90% accuracy that they're going to trip and fall in the next 3 weeks, they look at me as though I've completely lost my marbles and that's impossible. But it turns out we can put a Fitbit-like device, you know, some kind of sensor like the ones that you were talking about, either on your pants or on a bracelet on your ankle. And we can, if we detect anywhere from a 3 to 5 centimeter change in your normal walking gait, you have about an 85 to 90% probability that you're going to trip. We didn't know that was the precursor to tripping before. And the point that I make is, you know, about a third of the population in the United States is going to reach retirement age here in the next 10, 15 years. And when you really study the effects falling has on the elderly losing their ability to live independently, you realize that this is a phenomenal discovery, right? That we can anticipate the future and we could ping their cell phones and say, listen, you need to get into physical therapy. You're going to trip and fall. You're going to lose your ability to live independently. You'll wind up in an assisted living home. You know, stay off the stairs, uneven surfaces. There's a lot of things we could do prophylactically to keep people from injuring themselves. And that's just one simple, easy example, and there are thousands.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All right. Well, that dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront, so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter, yeah. That's right, where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time and will lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
If I asked you to finish this sentence, the elimination of risk means fill in the blank.
It means safety. You know, it means survival.
And is this part of that evolution that you were talking about in terms of humans? We need to know this because the risks are getting greater, perhaps, in our lives, or more lethal, the impacts?
Well, sure. Look at climate change as an example. I mean, no matter how you feel about whether humans contribute or how much humans contribute or whether we can even stop it, no matter how you feel, the effects of global, I don't even want to call it global warming anymore. I call it global burning. Because, you know, if you watch California this last year, you realize that we're quickly leaving warming to burning. And, you know, we have an obligation to act on that. And, you know, we have billions and billions of readings of the Earth's surface temperature at this particular point in time. So it's not really a debate in terms of whether the Earth's surface is warming. We know it is warming. It seems to me that we've gotten kind of distracted by this political debate about, well, humans are involved or they're not involved. I don't really care. I speak for a lot of Americans when I say, I don't care if humans are involved or not. It's lethal if we don't try to act on it. Now, I'm not saying that our actions will be successful. I don't know that. And I don't think we have our predictive models nailed down enough. But I do think that, look, if death is the potential downside, you know, a rational person would act on it.
Well, let's go back. I mean, when I think of the old weathermen, let's say, from 30, 40 years ago, and they were there with pen and a marker on television, and they said, I don't know what's happening in the next 5 days or 10 days, but I can tell you in the next few hours what may happen. Now we've gotten to a point where the science and the Doppler and like are really incredible, but they're still not foolproof. Where are we going, for example, with weather catastrophes? We're able now to evacuate cities, make preparation. How important is that, and how far will that ability to understand what's going on in our own natural environment be improved over the coming period?
Well, you know, the devastating hurricane that we had down in Texas, that was a kind of a landmark in terms of weather forecasting, because that was a very complicated hurricane. If you'll recall, It came inland for a period of time, dumped an enormous amount of rain, and then it went back into the water again, heated up, and then came back inward again. it's interesting that our satellites were, previous to the last 2 years, our satellites were collecting weather data about every 6 minutes. And now we're collecting updates in weather technology about or information about every 6 seconds. So imagine 6 minutes to 6 seconds, how much more accurate you start to become. And our computer models have gotten much, much more sophisticated. So in the case of this hurricane in Texas, it turns out that we had 5 working models, and of the 5, 3 of the 5 were spot on, not only in terms of time, the amount of rain that would be dumped, the course of the hurricane. And imagine that, that's just something that's happened over the last 2 years. So there should be no doubt in anyone's mind that we're going to get to a point where we improve to such a level that we will know the exact hour it's going to hit and what the impact is going to be to your neighborhood. This is how progress is. It's iterative.
Rebecca, a lot of people might wonder, the natural world we're talking about with weather, business impacts. I know that there's so much data now, and it's so empirically derived and so constant that a lot of people can make really good decisions if, in fact, they read the data. Or even human behavior. A lot of us really want to know what is in store. And, of course, when we talk about these school shootings, a lot of people want to preempt and be able to predict the people's behavior in those cases before it occurs. What's the easiest to model today? Is it human behavior, natural world, business impacts, or are they all getting pretty sophisticated?
Well, that's a good question. What's the most sophisticated? Right now, I will say it's business models. Business models on Wall Street are probably the most sophisticated because where there's money to buy the best programmers and the best computing, including moving away from classical computing to quantum computing, which I'm not going to go into because you literally have to be a physicist to understand how quantum computing works. But
we have many physicists listening to the podcast.
But it's coming to a neighborhood near you probably in the next decade, and it will eclipse computing as we know it today. Yes, I would say business probably has it nailed down the most. The example that I like to give is the largest retailer in the United States. When it came to their attention that as temperatures went up, milk production in cows would go down, as soon as they made that association, they began tapping NASA's meteorological database so that when they saw that there was going to be an increase in temperatures, they could lock in milk prices before anybody else did. And that gave them a phenomenal pricing advantage on a main staple like milk. So you can see that the competitive advantages of being able to get somewhere and lock in prices and know what the markets are going to do ahead of your competitors, that pays off in no time at all. So there's the motivation. But in terms of the natural environment, that's much more complex. But no matter what anybody thinks about physics, biology is 1,000 times more complicated. And when it gets to meteorological data, even more complex. So there's so many variables that even computers struggle to get it right. And we're not even talking about human judgment there. In terms of human behavior, again, a very, very complex thing. But we're getting to a point where we can put together algorithms which indicate a person is reaching criticality. The example I use is Stephen Paddock, the Las Vegas shooter. The problem is after these incidences, like the Parkland shooting in Florida and the Las Vegas shooting not too long ago, is that we work backwards. And as we work backwards, and everyone will relate to this as listening to this podcast, we make all these discoveries that there were all these warning signs. In each and every case, these people were depressed. In the case of Stephen Paddock, he owned 42 firearms, and he had started accelerating buying them. He had 1,600 rounds of ammunition. He had tried to buy tracer rounds, which are used to more accurately shoot in the evening. He'd sent his girlfriend away. His father was a violent sociopath who spent his life in prison. That's a heritable trait. Mm. And we find out that about 5 months before he went on this shooting rampage, he was prescribed diazepam, which should never be prescribed to someone who has a family history of mental illness and violence. And not only that, we know that he moved 27 times in the past 10 years and sent his girlfriend away and told her not to come back to the country. There were a lot of signs that when you start to string them all together, you say, okay, this person is reaching a point of criticality. They're warning signs. But here is the problem. We don't live in Tom Cruise's Minority Report. Remember that movie?
Yes.
We don't live in that world. We don't have the, we don't have precog police that come in, you know, look, you know, have access to all of your data, and then suddenly arrive at just as Stephen Paddock is breaking the window and pointing his gun, you know, toward the crowd, the concert goers. We don't have the precog police, you know, descend in from air vehicles and arrest him. Because we know for certainty that he's going to commit a crime. I mean, even after he broke the window and aimed his gun, he could have had a change of heart, right? This free will could have intervened.
Oh, absolutely. But what should we as a society, having all this data, all of this information on him, and these predictive models, I mean, ethically, then what are we left with?
Well, that's why I wrote this book. That's why I wrote On the Verge, because we have to have that conversation now. Because they're, you know, we're putting our head in the sand and we're acting like we don't have the data. And then after the event happens, we go, well, we had all the data, so who can we blame? Now, that to me, as a scientist, is just the, you know, the way that idiots work. I mean, if you've got the data and you have the opportunity to prevent something like this, you should act on it. But the question is, what do our laws allow? And ethically and morally, what can we allow? Can we detain people for a period of time to give them a spacer between a violent act and committing it, a violent thought and committing a violent act? You know, there's some evidence that if you pull people out of those situations and you give them a small reprieve, they may not act on those. But again, everybody is so freaked out that the government is monitoring our metaphone data, you know, our metadata off of our phones. Are we going to give the government access, or even if not the government, an independent organization, access to everything from medical records to our financial records to everything so that they can pull these algorithms together and look at them objectively and find out who is at risk of committing these terrible acts? I don't know. It's not whether science can do it. It's whether society wants science to do it.
Oh, absolutely. And how fearful do we have to become? And America is becoming a pretty fearful society. To say, yes, if you can take that risk and that threat off the streets, do what you need to do.
Well, some people feel that way. Some people say, no, this is, you know, we're just going to have to live with it because otherwise we got Big Brother poking into lots of areas that I don't feel comfortable. On the other hand, it could be like a photo release or a video release. You know, maybe some of us are willing to sign a release and say, I don't really care. You know, I can only speak for myself, and I'm not trying to convince anybody, but I don't really care if the government listens in on my phone conversations. If they got nothing better to do, have at it. You know.
Well, let me ask you, with all the predictive technology and all that we can know, and we're so fearful, of course, of terrorism, the impacts of all of this ability that we now have, could this really be the way to eliminate terrorism? We should be able to quell it before it occurs?
We can. We can eliminate and prophylactically stop every single terrorist act. We have the technology to do it.
Should we? Are we? The Patriot Act, some people thought it went too far.
I can't answer that. That's not for me to answer. I'm a scientist and a technologist. I can only tell you what's available.
Well, what's the impact on our politics with all of this capability?
This is the problem. You know, public policy always trails technology. You used the self-driving cars as an example, okay? We just got done in most states implementing laws that say you can't text and drive, right? Which are going to be good for, what, a total of 24 months? Then it doesn't matter because it's self-driving cars, so text away. you know, so first we got the cars, then we got the cell phones, then we decided, well, we're killing people because the cars and cell phones got together. You know, they get to operate at the same time. So then we make laws that say you can't text and drive at the same time. And now here comes the self-driving cars, and the laws are obsolete.
Or but, we put a lot of people out of work during the last recession, and then they get a job with Uber or Lyft, and they're back or they're employed, and a lot of guys employ driving, and then driving is no longer an option as an occupation.
Well, exactly. So, you know, there's a tango, if you will, that takes place between technology and public policy and social trends. There is a dance. We don't understand, and I don't care if it's an economist that's talking or a politician that's talking, we don't quite understand that sociodynamic right now.
Well, that's why we need a sociobiologist, and that's why we have you on the line, Rebecca Costa, On the Verge. Now, speaking of On the Verge, now this is fascinating to me. Body scans, the genome testing, the ability to predict what disease may befall you in the future, what that means to all kinds of industries in terms of the medical industry, the health insurance industry, the life insurance industry. Play it all out for us.
That's a good example. You know, right now everybody's worried about health insurance and group policies. Well, group policies are going to be gone within the next 5 to 10 years because genetically we know what diseases you're predisposed to at the time you're born. We've broken down the human genome and we now know what kinds of cancers or whether you're predisposed to violent behavior. We know if you're predisposed to Alzheimer's and mental illness. I mean, we know all this stuff. Think of all the cancers. There are thousands of cancers we can test you for genetically. Now, for people who are not geneticists that may be listening today, that doesn't mean it's not determinist. It doesn't mean you're going to get that cancer. You may be predisposed to have lung cancer and smoke all you want and never get it. You'll die of something else. But think of medical science and how much we can predict now that you are susceptible to particular, and you know what the next step is. Once you know the cause and the susceptibility of something, you have the opportunity to alter that future. And that's exactly what this conversation today is about.
Absolutely.
It's about altering the future by having the information to know what that future is most likely to be.
And tell us, what industries are most in jeopardy as a result of that which you see on the verge and the predictive analytics? Are there things we're not going to need anymore, or professions or livelihoods that are going to be jeopardized by all of this?
Well, it's going to be a sea change. You know, every industry will be affected by this. We were just talking about medicine. You know, medicine will be about acting prophylactically to prevent diseases that you are susceptible to more than the mainstream population. Insurance industry will be developing a unique policy just for you, depending on what your odds look like. And they're going to be looking at not just your genetic inheritance, but your behavioral markers. What kinds of things do you do on a day-in and day-out basis? And they'll be able to use sensor technology and other kinds of data, like monitor your Facebook stuff, your emails. You may even allow them to have cameras in certain locations, and they will raise and lower your insurance rates based on those behavioral markers and genetic predispositions, as well as environmental things, where you live. You know, are the incidences of certain cancers higher in the areas that you live? So, you know, all those factors are going to come to bear, and we're going to get pretty accurate on what your profile, what your future looks like from a health standpoint. You know, I think every industry will be affected by this. You know, I use an example of heading off the opioid crisis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a company called Fuzzy Logics that currently has a medical questionnaire, and they look at certain behavioral markers that can test within 85% or so whether you are predisposed to become an opioid addict before the doctor writes that first prescription. And we now know that all the addicts got started by a doctor's legal first prescription. I think it should be mandatory that before they give you a prescription for opioids, that they have you take this questionnaire and they inform you that, hey, you might be in the 90 percentile of the profile of the individual that is predisposed to become an addict. And would you like me to recommend a different kind of pain management strategy? I would want to know that.
Oh, absolutely. You give us 12 principles of adaptation during this period of exponential change. And you say, though, that failure is more common than success. And yet, if we have so many variables that we can now account for, why is there not going to be more success given all that we can know and not have to guess?
Well, there will be. Over time, there will be more successes than failures because that's what it means to be able to accurately anticipate. But there's always the unintended consequences. You know, my friend Barry Kibrick said to me, well, you could anticipate that I'll die of cancer, you know, or that I'm going to trip and fall next week. But if I get hit by a car tomorrow, your predictions are bad. and that sums it up. Yes, but predictions are all about odds, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? You can say, well, you know, all things being equal, getting hit by a car, no exceptional events, you're in the 85 percentile or you're in the 90 percentile. And the way that technology works is whatever's at 85 or 90% today will be 100% in a short amount of time.
And how much do we have to continue to evolve as human beings? Or is the artificial intelligence that we're building and the way that these algorithms can do so much that we, with our limits, cannot, that we really are okay where we are? Or 100 years from now, what will the human condition be like biologically to be able to keep up with all of this?
What will the human condition be like?
Mm.
You assume I've got a big algorithm.
I know.
Here
I know. Well, you're telling us so much about the future. I say, let me, you know, go for the fences here with you.
Well, I appreciate that. I do not have a crystal ball. I can only report on what is going on today and what is available today so that we can get the conversation started. Because I find that our leaders are so behind in terms of their knowledge of science and technology. And, you know, one day someone asked me, I think it was one of my kids, asked me this. They said, Mom, what's the opposite of politics? And I said, science. Science. Science and data is the opposite of politics. I truly believe this. And I believe, you know, we're generating as much data every 24 to 48 hours as we did from the dawn of humankind to year 2003. And that means every Friday we go home and that universe of data has been recreated Monday morning when we go into work.
That's
now,
amazing.
No one can argue that when we start mining that data, that massive amount of data we're producing, we are making discoveries at so fast a rate that no one can keep up. Even myself, who is a sociobiologist and a futurist and who talks about this, I have to read so much every day. Can I confess something? I read two books a day.
Really?
Two whole books a day, and they aren't easy books. Now, they're books written by scientists, and, you know, sometimes I have to read the
what did you read today?
Over and over again.
What'd you read today?
Well, I will tell you, I read Hardwiring Happiness by Rick Hansen and also The Hidden Wealth of Nations by David Halpern.
Oh, my goodness. Well, let me ask you, well, then somebody who is not
funny
reading...
You asked, but
okay. Well, you got me there. Will someone who is not really quite as astute and a fast reader like yourself, who will be disadvantaged in this era of plenty of data? Who is going to be disadvantaged, or are we all going to benefit equally from this?
Well, no. You know, this is why I appreciate this conversation that we're having and getting this information out to people, because these predictive models, the downside of them is they create a predatory environment, right? Because the people who have the tools and know what the future is going to bring, right, they can take advantage of the rest of us, and there's nowhere that's more apparent than on the stock market. You know, about 5 years ago, I pulled all my money out of the stock market and went into things like CDs, and everyone laughed at me and said, oh, you're the worst investor ever. And that could be true. I could confess to that. Possibly I am. But the reason I did that is because I cannot name this person, but I was invited by a billionaire many times over who has an island out in the South Pacific. And he has a home that's like the size of a hotel, and he invites thinkers to see him. And one day I was sort of roaming around, and he said, "Well, come on into my war room." And he had a giant wall, and it had little oil wells all over the world, and underneath it was a little ticker symbol, and each ticker was moving, and it was showing the rate at which every single oil well in the entire world was depleting the source underneath it. Now, I looked at this and I said, what is that? And he started to explain that he could tell which reserves were going dry and where there were going to be problems. And so this guy, he had information that I didn't even know existed. And so at that point, on my plane ride home, I was sitting there and I was thinking, what chance do I have on Wall Street? Not very good.
What will be the nemesis of all of this information and now predictability and having all of these data points available to us? Is it going to be inaction, or is it going to be somebody exponentially making the wrong decision, taking all the right data, but making the wrong decision? What is it that we're going to be looking at in terms of the pace that is going to be possible, or is possible today, but with all this information, that still things could go wrong?
You know, like I said, there's free will, right?
Mm-hmm.
That there are unanticipated events which occur in life. But I think the point of this conversation is more of it's predictable than is unpredictable. I can't account for getting hit by a car, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I probably could give you some probabilities on being hit by a car based on how often I drive, where I live, and the number of accidents, so on and so forth, right?
Yeah, and we're also making the car safer by having all of these intelligences built into the car over time.
That's right, and even cars themselves are beginning to anticipate, right?
Absolutely.
Thanks to very, very sharp algorithms and sensors, your car will stop if it senses an object.
Yeah, I have that.
You could even hit the brake.
Yeah, I have that. Rebecca Costa, I can't thank you enough. This is so fascinating. It really is. On the verge, if there was one piece of information that predictably I didn't ask that you really want to make certain that our podcast listeners have, is there anything we left out of this discussion?
No, I would just suggest to people that have the conversation now. Watch the movie Minority Report. It brings up some ethical questions that I think we have to start talking about, because science can anticipate the future. We just need to make a decision as to whether we're going to act on it or not.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us today. A great guest, Rebecca Costa, the book On the Verge.
Thank you.
Yeah, you were terrific.